Good morning. So, as a lot of you know, before we moved to Fort McMurray, moved to Calgary about 15 years ago, Karen and I we came from Fort McMurray, and we were both journalists up there. We worked in newspapers as reporters and editors. Now, at that time, Fort McMurray was a pretty small city, it was a pretty small paper, and we had a pretty small newsroom, pretty small staff of reporters and editors. So we didn't get to specialize as much in the kinds of stories that we would cover as reporters and editors would in bigger cities. We got to cover a real variety of things, and there was definitely some upsides to that. This variety of stories, and one of my favorite types of stories to write was the hometown hero story. These were stories about people who grew up in Fort McMurray or had spent a lot of time there in their life, but they've gone on to other places and went on to do big things. People like military heroes and politicians, and a lot of times they were rising stars in sports or entertainment. These stories were a lot of fun to write, and they were really, really well read. They popped for people. These local boys and local girls make good kind of stories. The stories about our hometown heroes. And that's not just a Fort McMurray phenomenon, obviously. If you know, here in Calgary, I think a lot of people are pretty proud that Jan Arden, the singer-songwriter, is from here. And if you go to the central Alberta town of Viking, you won't have to look very far to find evidence that the Sutter family is from there. The Sutter family had a number of children. Six of the brothers went on to play in the NHL and coach as well, and they had distinguished careers. And a lot of the Sutters ended up on the Calgary Flames at one time or another as well. And if you go beyond Alberta and you go to Philadelphia, you'll find a statue of Rocky Balboa. Go to Bemidji, Minnesota, which is fun to say, Bemidji, you'll find statues of Paul Bunyan and Babe the Blue Ox. Now, you probably are aware that Rocky Balboa and Paul Bunyan are fictional characters. So apparently we don't even care that much if our hometown heroes actually existed. That's how gaga we are for the idea of hometown heroes. And we often put our hometown heroes up on a pedestal a lot of the time, don't we? We feel like they're kind of special. They can kind of do no wrong. We feel like they put our hometowns on the map, and their specialness makes us feel special too. So like I said, we put them on a pedestal. But in today's gospel reading, we see the opposite at play, don't we? Because Jesus is doing some awesome things elsewhere. He's getting really famous and making a real name for himself. But Jesus, of all people, gets rejected in his hometown. And he can't do any miracles there. If I was still a newspaper editor, I think my headline for the story would go like this: Hometown Hero Stumped by the Stubborn. This is a great story from the gospel, and I think it might be a familiar story for many of us, but I think there are still lessons, maybe lessons we need a reminder about, or maybe something that hasn't occurred to us before. So let's spend some time with our gospel reading today, and let's begin by, as we often do, by getting our bearings, where we are in the story. So we are in the sixth chapter of Mark's Jesus story. And over the past five chapters, Jesus has been on the move. And that's a common thing in the Gospel of Mark. Jesus is kind of always on the move. But in the past five chapters, he's been all around the region of the Sea of Galilee. And he's been doing some amazing things. He's driven out some impure spirits. He's healed sicknesses. And he's had some interesting run-ins with religious leaders and come out on top of these sort of tête-à-têtes. And I think that's endeared him to the people a little bit. And he calmed a storm just by speaking to it. And in the chapter just before this one, he cast a legion of demons into a herd of pigs. And this happened in Gentile territory. Well, then he crossed the lake back into Galilee, And as we heard last week, he healed a woman without even knowing about it until it was happening. And then, if that wasn't spectacular enough, to sort of close the first act of his ministry, Jesus raised a little girl from the dead. So it's pretty clear that Jesus is on a roll in this town, in that town, in Jewish territory, in Gentile territory. Jesus just, he seems unstoppable. And then in today's reading, he returns to his hometown of Nazareth, and on the Sabbath day, we hear that he goes to the synagogue to teach. And at first, people seem really impressed by him. They don't seem to recognize him, but they're, as verse 2 says, that many who heard him were amazed. It goes like this: "Where did this man get these teachings?" they asked. "What's this wisdom that has been given him? What are these remarkable miracles he's performing?" So they're pretty impressed. But then in verse 3, there's kind of a shift. It's as if they suddenly recognize him. It's like, wait a minute, I know this guy. Isn't this the carpenter? Isn't this Mary's son and the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? Aren't his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him. Offense? What's up with that? What cause would they have to be offended at him? And when I read this, you know, even though this is so long ago and all that, I get offended on Jesus' behalf. I get annoyed at these Nazarenes. It's like in the first chapter of John, there's a little story about a guy named Nathanael. When he hears that Jesus is from Nazareth, well, he's not impressed. He says, "Nazareth? Can anything good come from there?" And, you know, I'm sort of tempted to side with Nathanael here, that the Nazarenes, they're not very impressive in this moment. They're kind of despicable, in fact. But it's important to remember that the Nazarenes, like all of us, they're a product of their time and place. And in first century Palestine, a person's status was understood as fixed. The categories you were born into kind of defined who you were for your whole life. And what were the categories that Jesus fell into, according to the Nazarenes? Well, they said that he's Mary's son, not Joseph's son, the carpenter. So, translation, he's a low-level manual laborer, and the identity of his father is kind of sketchy. And the Nazarenes are so locked in their categories that the idea of him amounting to anything else just didn't compute. They couldn't entertain the possibility that something so extraordinary could come from something so familiar and such dubious origins. I like the way the Message version of the Bible paraphrases verse 3. It goes like this: "But in the next breath, they were cutting him down. He's just a carpenter, Mary's boy. We've known him since he was a kid. We know his brothers, James, Justice, Jude, and Simon, and his sisters. Who does he think he is?" They tripped over him. They tripped over what little they knew about him and fell, sprawling. And they never got any further. That's helpful color on verse 3, and it's also, you know, a good warning for us, I think. But we'll get to that in a bit here. Back to our usual translation, the New International Version, and let's pick things up in verse 4. Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor except in his own town, among his relatives, and in his own home." And this reminds me of a story that we get in Mark chapter 3, where Jesus is fairly early in his ministry, and he's out doing some interesting things and saying some provocative things. And his family hear about it, and they're mortified. And they come to take charge of him because they thought he was out of his mind. They just assumed the worst about him. And so where Jesus says that a prophet is without honor among his relatives, I mean, he's clearly speaking from experience, and now he's been also rejected by his neighbors, not just his family. That must have stung, don't you think? And then in verse 5, we come to the part where our hometown hero is stumped by the stubborn. He could not do any miracles there except lay his hands on a few sick people and heal them. He was amazed at their lack of faith. Incidentally, this is the only time in Mark where it says that Jesus was amazed. But what amazes me is that Mark says that Jesus couldn't do any miracles there, except heal a few sick people, you know, nothing special. It's as if Mark is kind of glossing over that, but that's still mind-blowingly amazing for anyone else, isn't it? I mean, still healing some sick people. But apparently Mark doesn't think it's much to write home about, because the takeaway is that, practically speaking, Jesus couldn't do any miracles there. Jesus couldn't. Those are two words that don't really seem to belong together, do they? I mean, Jesus is God made flesh. What on earth could be powerful enough to neutralize Jesus' power to perform miracles? Well, I think there's a clue in the fact that Jesus is still able to heal a few sick people. Because if you look at the healing stories in Mark's gospel, one thing that most of them have in common is that people brought their concerns to Jesus and asked for his help. He didn't like just walk around zapping people who didn't seem to want any help. They came to him. They let Jesus in. So why was Jesus able to still heal a few sick people in Nazareth? I think it's because a few people still came to him. A few people came and they let Jesus in. But the vast majority rejected him. And the number of people who did come was so measly and so paltry that it felt like next to nothing. And so Mark characterized it that way. Jesus could barely do any miracles there, because barely anyone asked him to. So what's powerful enough to neutralize Jesus' power to perform miracles? Seems like the answer is human free will. If we don't let Jesus in, he respects our choices. And I think that's what happened with the Nazarenes. Because of their stubbornness, they wouldn't let Jesus in, and so as a result, Jesus is amazed at their lack of faith. I wonder how often Jesus is amazed at my lack of faith. It's easy to look down our noses at the Nazarenes, but are we really all that different today? I mean, maybe we don't sneer at him and deliberately exclude Jesus like the Nazarenes did. But for those of us who grew up in North America or Europe, we've kind of inherited a Western worldview that really doesn't leave a lot of room for miracles, does it? I mean, like the Nazarenes, we're all products of our time and place. And are we as stuck in our categories as they were in theirs? If you look at our society and the things that we value, there's a real emphasis on independence and self-reliance. We use the phrase self-made man or self-made woman with admiration. And you know, to giving credit where it's due, humanity has built some incredible technology and a wonderful social safety net that helps provide for the needy. Not perfect, but it's pretty impressive in a lot of ways. And I wonder if we're so reliant on our human ability that we've sort of forgotten how to leave room for Jesus. As societies and as individuals, too. I think we're not as good at deliberately letting Jesus in as we could be. And I wonder if we're missing out as a result. Maybe we're missing out on miracles that Jesus wants to provide for us, but I'm not sure that having our needs and wants met is the point. What we're really missing out on, I think, are opportunities to spend more time with God and to trust in God more fully. That's how we grow in relationship with Jesus, and that's how we build our faith. So let me ask you, in what ways are you so self-reliant that you don't leave room for miracles? In what areas of your life do you struggle to remember to let Jesus in? And what miracles might you be missing out on as a result? Okay, let's move on. As our gospel reading continues, Jesus leaves Nazareth and he goes around teaching from village to village. And then he sends out the 12 disciples on a mission and provides really specific instructions around what they're supposed to do and what they're allowed to bring. Verse 7, calling the 12 to him, he began to send them out two by two and gave them authority over impure spirits. These were his instructions. Take nothing for the journey except a staff. No bread, no bag, no money in your belts. Wear sandals, but not an extra shirt. So Jesus let them have a walking stick that they could also use for protection against bandits or wild animals. But once they got to the villages, they had to be totally dependent on their hosts. Jesus wants them to have to trust that God would care for them through the hospitality of others. Can you imagine how you'd feel if you were one of the 12? You're sent to wander and look for people to heal and to preach to, and you've really got no idea how they might respond. And you're not allowed to take anything for the journey. No food, no money, not even an extra shirt that you could use as a bedroll or a pillow. You're totally, totally at the mercy of the people or the environment. For us self-reliant modern Westerners, this sounds positively insane, but I bet it wasn't an easy pill to swallow in Jesus' day either. And then, if the people in a community won't welcome or listen to you, you're supposed to leave and shake the dust from your feet as a testimony against them. That's pretty dramatic, don't you think? And a little bit presumptuous, too. I imagine that some, like this is, they're in Galilee, and a lot of the disciples were from that region. They're from Galilee. So they may even have like come into villages that they'd been to before, and maybe people would recognize them. And they know that you know, these disciples, they're not the prophet, they're not Jesus. They're just, you know, this ex-fisherman or this ex-tax collector or whatever. And he's going to try and tell me how it is. And if I don't like him, he's going to, like, leave in a huff and shake the dust from his sandals. Speaking of who does he think he is, right? And remember that here in Mark's gospel, this all happened right after Jesus himself got rejected and in his hometown. I don't know about you, but if I was one of the 12, I'd have been pretty freaked out by this whole assignment. And I think that's the point. It seems like the sending of the 12 and the rejection at Nazareth don't just happen sequentially, but they're connected. The rejection seems to be like the catalyst for the sending of the 12, at least in Mark. It's like Jesus says, after being rejected at home, he turns up the volume on his story, kind of said, oh yeah, reject me, will ya? And then he sends his deputies out to the surrounding villages to heal and teach. And when I said deputies just now, if what came to your mind was some dim-witted comic relief sidekick in an old Western movie or a TV show, well, you're not necessarily on the wrong track. Because if you read Mark's gospel, you'll notice that the portrait of the 12 disciples, it's not very flattering. There are a lot of examples of Jesus scolding the disciples for their lack of faith or understanding. And really very few where we see Jesus impressed by any of them. Not a lot of high fives going on in Mark's gospel. And that's true before today's story and after. The sense we get in Mark is that during Jesus' earthly ministry, at least, the disciples just they don't get it. They don't get what Jesus was up to. And yet here in Mark 6, Jesus sends them out anyway. And what's even more surprising is that these deputies are successful in their mission. Verse 12, they went out and preached that people should repent. They drove out many demons and anointed many sick people with oil and healed them. They did it. They got the job done. How could they have done that? Well, I think it's important to remember that they didn't do anything. What was accomplished through them was accomplished by Jesus' power, because Jesus had deputized them and given them authoritative power to do God's work on his behalf. So Jesus still did the heavy lifting. He just used the disciples' muscles to do it. And I think the implications for us are pretty clear. The disciples weren't passive beneficiaries of their teacher. Jesus had something important for them to do, to contribute. And not having it all figured out didn't get them off the hook. On the contrary, this experience, I think, was an important part of the lesson plan. This is how they connected the dots on some of the things that Jesus had said, I think. I think the disciples probably learned more about the kingdom from these hands-on experiences than anything they would have learned from watching Jesus work or hearing him teach. And maybe more shockingly is that being totally unqualified for the job by every conceivable human standard, that was no excuse either. That didn't get them off the hook either. And maybe even more excitingly, being totally unqualified for the job was also no barrier for success. And I think there's something here that we can learn from too. And I think this is particularly relevant here in Alberta, as COVID-19 restrictions are starting to lift and businesses and organizations are starting to reopen or are moving in that direction. Businesses and organizations, including Holy Trinity, this church. I think it's important for us to remember that God calls us to serve in our homes, in our communities, and in our churches. And that having our theology all figured out is not a prerequisite for service. If it were, no one would be serving. So as restrictions relax, I want to challenge all of us to reflect on how God is calling us to serve in a post-pandemic world. Notice I didn't say I want us to reflect on whether God is calling each of us to serve. I said how, because I'm convinced that now, more than ever, we are in an all-hands-on-deck situation when it comes to mission, ministry, and service. Everyone is needed. And if you feel totally unqualified, well, that should be the beginning of the conversation, not the end. Talk to Pastor Stephen, talk to me. Let's figure this out. Let's see where the sweet spot is. And of course, pray. Let's pray about it. So I don't think we have a choice on whether we're called to serve. I think we're called to serve. But we do have a choice on how we can view this calling. We can look at it as an obligation to do our part and pull our weight. Or we can look at it as an opportunity to participate in what God is doing in the world. Do we gotta serve, or do we get to serve? Because if you think about it, like, Mark doesn't say a lot about what it was like for the disciples in this story as Jesus used their muscles to do his heavy lifting. But I gotta imagine that it was an awesome experience. Probably the highlight of their lives so far. And I think Jesus might want to use the decline of this pandemic like a springboard to propel each of us into greater service than we've ever offered before, and not coincidentally, into deeper faith than we've ever experienced before. If only we'll let Jesus in and let him deputize us. So, let me ask you, in what ways do you live like you think serving is only for people who have it all figured out? And what miracles might you be missing out on because of that tendency? In what areas can you increasingly be of service as the pandemic continues to decline? And to what extent are you going to allow God to propel you into greater service and deeper faith in the latter half of 2021 and beyond? In our reading today, Jesus, the hometown hero, was stumped by the stubborn, by the rejection of his former neighbors in Nazareth. And that rejection was the catalyst for fresh ministry by a bunch of ordinary people who didn't have it all figured out. And yet, they got the job done. In the words of scholar Clifton Black, that's because, in Mark, there's no stopping the good news, but no telling how it breaks through. I like that. One last thing. You might have noticed that even though Jesus tells the disciples to shake the dust off their feet as they leave towns that reject them, the text doesn't say that Jesus shook the dust off his feet as a testimony against the people of Nazareth. I don't think he ever did. I don't think he ever does. I don't think Jesus ever washes his hands of anyone. Not the people who don't quite measure up, and not even the people who completely reject him. That's what the love of God looks like. And thank God for that. I've spoken in the name of the Father, of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.